Welcome to the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, April 6th. I want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy because you might want to take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any information you can use to take action. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, April 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park here in Santa Cruz. As luck would have it, we will get more rain before our work party on Saturday. This will provide great conditions for our continuing efforts on the removal of invasive non-native French broom. Afterwards, don't forget to stop by the California Native Plant Society's Spring Plant Sale. Directions on how to get to Quail Hollow: go up Graham Hill Road or north out of Santa Cruz. As you come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the light and proceed up East Ziandy Road for 2 miles. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road and go a half a mile up to the entrance to the park on your right, and they'll meet in the gravel parking area on the left side of the entrance road. Once again, that's this Saturday, April 8th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. If you'd like more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her email address is redwoodrn@packbell.net. That's redwoodrn@packbell.net. And for the first time, the Earth First Round River Rendezvous will be held online. This from the Earth First Newswire on April 1st. Each summer for the last 36 years, Earth Firsters and other environmental activists from around the world have gathered in national forests and private lands for the Earth First Round River Rendezvous, or just plain Rendezvous. A week-long event where people can share skills, network, foster a culture of resistance. In 2017, for the first time, the Earth First movement is adapting to the times by hosting the Rendezvous is an online-only Facebook event. Citing complaints about the traditional rendezvous format, including the strain that travel puts on the environment, the toll of constantly digging shitters, and the inability of introverted Earth Firsters to properly socialize, the 2017 Rendezvous crew decided to take a daring leap and try something new. This year, Rendezvous-goers won't have to follow the hastily written directions through the winding mountain roads to find the Rendezvous campsite. Instead, anyone with a Facebook profile can indicate that they are interested in the 2017 Rendezvous and then comment on the various workshop events offered through the Facebook page. Morning Circle will be hosted on an event page with a survey-style consensus process. Trainings and skill shares will be offered through various online mediums, including interactive videos and online drag-and-drop games. And the Night to Howl and Rally and Talent Show will now be SoundCloud and YouTube compatible. Furthermore, a hashtag, most likely hashtag 2017RRRSucks, will be provided for anyone who wants to make callouts on Twitter, and they don't even have to participate in the Rendezvous to do so. For those of you thinking, what about action? The Rendezvous always ends with something getting shut down. Don't worry, the Rendezvous crew is way ahead of you. Not only will there be a massive online action at the end of the camp, likely with record numbers thanks to the ability to participate from home or work, but the online aspect will allow Earthers attending the Rendezvous to take action every single day through online petitions, commenting on Facebook pages, and liking radical groups. We hope you'll join Earth First in bringing radical environmental politics into the 21st century, and more importantly, to the people. We'll see you on the World Wide Web. And I have to add the Earth First Newswire editor's note. This article is fake news. It's an April Fool's joke. We hoped it was obvious, but after this April Fool's article got us passionate calls from environmentalists in Texas, one spread hilarious but confusing gossip, and another got us angry phone calls and unmet demands from the Colorado Department of Agriculture, we thought we should be clear. The 2017 Round River Rendezvous is to be put on in Northern California, not online, by an amazing crew of eco-defenders who will take place for about 1 week in June or July. Keep an eye out on the Newswire for the real update for more specific dates and locations. Also take note of which friends shared this story on Facebook and thought it was really true, having only read the headline, and then stop trusting the headlines that they share with you. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project writes, please help us save old-growth forest in the Walton Lake Recreation Area of the Ochoco National Forest. Comments are due by April 17th. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project already challenged this insidious Forest Service proposal to log old-growth forest and large trees within the Ochoco National Forest's most popular recreation site at Walton Lake when it was first proposed under a categorical exclusion to speed up and short-circuit the public involvement process. However, the Forest Service is back again with basically the same disastrous timber sale proposed under the guise of logging to control root rot and thus protect public health and safety, even though logging is known to spread root rot. Root rot is a natural disturbance agent that moves slowly, creating small openings in the forest and snags beneficial to woodpeckers. Logging to control root rot would not significantly reduce root rot unless the entire root systems of the affected trees were removed, and even then it would likely remain in the soil in wood fragments. It is inconsistent with the stated purpose and need for the Walton Lake Project to log to control root rot since logging spreads it. A commercial logging proposal would completely transform the Walton Lake Recreation Center by clear-cutting existing large and old firs within beautiful old-growth forests visible from the lake and campground area. The devastation of planned logging removal of about 571 trees equal or greater to 21 inches diameter, plus clear cuts removing all fir trees, such as root rot host species, even if they do not have root rot, would permanently change the character of Walton Lake area to a heavily logged site. The lake area would be unrecognizable to generations of Oregonians and other visitors who experienced a sense of place here with memories of big old-growth firs and intact old-growth forest. To add insult to injury, the Forest Service would replant heavily logged areas with only ponderosa pine and western larch, even though the forest is a naturally moist mixed conifer, thus attempting to artificially convert the existing moist mixed old-growth forest to a dry forest with young trees. The Forest Service also proposes to log out existing large Douglas fir and grand fir, as they estimate to be younger than 150 years old in the commercial thinning sale units, even though these are the minority in these drier ponderosa pine-dominant stands and pose no real threat to the old pines. We need your help to stop this timber sale. Go to the website for more talking points. Comments can be submitted online by April 17th at CARA.ecosystem-management.org/public/commentinput?project=4947019. And let me repeat that. That's CARA.ecosystem-management.org/public/commentinput?project=4749. And you can also mail your comments to arrive by April 17th to Marcy Anderson, Walton Lake Restoration Project, 3160 Northeast 3rd Street, Prineville, Oregon, 97754. Once again, that address, Marcy Anderson, Walton Lake Restoration Project, 3160 Northeast 3rd Street, Prineville, Oregon, 97754. And the website is Blue Mountains Biodiversity .org. Excuse me, BlueMountainBiodiversity.org. And Japan has killed more than 300 whales in its annual Antarctic hunt, as we read in The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A Japanese whaling fleet returned to port last Friday after an annual Antarctic hunt that killed more than 300 of the mammals as Tokyo pursues the program in defiance of global criticism. The fleet set sail for the Southern Ocean in November with plans to slaughter 333 minke whales, flouting a worldwide moratorium in opposition led by Australia and New Zealand. The fleet consisted of five ships, three of which arrived on Friday morning at Shimonoseki Port in western Japan, the country's fishing agency said. More than 200 people, including crew members and their families, gathered in the rain for a 30-minute ceremony in front of the Nishin Maru, the fleet's main ship, according to an official of the Shimonoseki city government. In a press release, the agency described the mission as a research for the purpose of studying ecological systems of the Antarctic Sea. But environmentalists, including the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and the International Court of Justice, call that a fiction and say the real purpose is simply to hunt whales for their meat. Participating in the fleet's return animal protection charity Humane Society International called for an end to Japanese whaling. Each year that Japan persists with its discredited scientific whaling is another year that these wonderful animals are needlessly sacrificed, said Kitty Block, the group's executive vice president. This is an obscene cruelty in the name of science that must end. Japan also caught 333 minke whales in a previous season ending in 2016 after a one-year hiatus prompted by an international jurist court ruling, which said the hunt was a commercial venture masquerading as science and ordered Tokyo to end it. Under the International Whaling Commission, to which Japan is a signatory, there has been a moratorium on hunting whales since 1986. Tokyo exploits a loophole allowing whales to be killed for scientific research and claims it is trying to prove the population is large enough to sustain a return to commercial hunting. But it also makes no secret of the fact that the whale meat ends up on dinner tables and is served in school lunches. Japan has hunted whales for centuries, and their meat was a key source of protein in the immediate post-Second World War years, when the country was desperately poor. But consumption has dramatically declined in recent decades, with significant portions of the population saying they never or rarely eat whale meat. In response to the international court ruling, Japan's 2014-15 mission carried out only non-lethal research, such as taking skin samples and doing head counts. Past missions have been hampered by a confrontational campaign on the high seas by environmentalists of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. A fisheries agent official said that the whalers this time faced no obstructive behavior threatening the safety of the fleet and crew members by the group. He attributed that partially to Japan dispatching patrol ships to protect the fleet. And grizzly bears have been awakened with the buffalo migration in this story from the Buffalo Field Campaign. Buffalo are all over the Hebgen Basin right now along the western boundary of Yellowstone National Park. Horse Butte and the neighboring Yellowstone Hebgen Village and Hebgen Lake Estates is teeming with the gentle giants. Most residents have huge smiles on their faces, and we've seen people out walking their dogs with the buffalo close by. There's a group of buffalo who just arrived along Highway 287, and we're hopeful that they will head toward the Buffalo Field headquarters for a visit. It still feels surreal that they have found year-round habitat and most hazing threats are over. Unfortunately, there is still a large number of buffalo along the south side of the Madison River, an area where buffalo are still unwelcome, and two Department of Livestock inspectors did a reconnaissance yesterday morning and are aware of them. It seems right now conditions on the ground might be too slushy for any hazing, but we will be ready when the time comes. Our recent field patrols have been peaceful. We have been dealing with a few highway crossings, but with so much snow gone, the buffalo aren't getting locked onto the highway and are able to move across the land more freely. While we continue to prioritize highway patrols day and night, we have also been able to get out on the land to do lots of scouting. Everywhere we walk, the muddy ground or the remaining snow is covered with buffalo tracks. It is a gift to walk in their footsteps. And it's not just buffalo we are blessed to encounter. We are blessed with magical moments when we spot moose, elk, golden and bald eagles, ravens and trumpeter swans, sandhill cranes, white pelicans, foxes, coyotes, and the tracks of wolves and grizzly bears. On a recent patrol, our volunteers were thrilled when they spotted very fresh grizzly tracks. It is always so humbling to come across these massive footprints and know that you share the forests and fields with such a sacred, powerful being. After a long winter's nap, grizzly bears, which are federally protected under the endangered species, are hungry. Two of their most important food sources right now are either winter-killed buffalo or elk, and indeed buffalo meat is becoming increasingly important to buffalo grizzly bears due to the impacts that climate change is wreaking on their other high-protein foods, such as cutthroat trout, white pine nuts, and army cutworm moths. These latter foods have traditionally been mostly enjoyed by mama bears and their cubs, while the boars tend to eat more ungulate meat. But with the losses of these important foods, moms and cubs are looking for buffalo too. This is actually increasing grizzly bear deaths as it brings cubs into more frequent contact with the boars, who sometimes kill them. It also brings more bears into contact with hunters in the fall. The solution is simple: allow more buffalo on a larger landscape. Many of the buffalo we are seeing are showing signs of having lived through a difficult winter, and there is one particularly adult female injured and as thin as any buffalo we have ever seen, on whom we are keeping a very close eye. We are hopeful that she will make it, though her chances are not good. If she doesn't, she will go back into the cycle of life, providing needed nutrients to a hungry grizzly bear. The Yellowstone bioregion is the only place in America where wild bison and grizzly bears have coexisted since time immemorial. Buffalo are an essential component of the ecological rich habitat on which they have always lived. Yet the Forest Service, the agency charged with managing much of this habitat, continues to refuse to classify wild bison as a species of conservation concern or a focal species. We would like to send a buffalo-sized thanks to all of our supporters who have taken action, writing letters and attending public meetings to urge the Forest Service to admit to the importance of native free migrating bison. And for more information, go to the webpage buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group on the land every day in protection of wild buffalo. And California and Nevada have recorded their first wolves in nearly 100 years. In the summer of 2015, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife made a thrilling announcement that a family of wolves had made their home in the Golden State. The announcement was spurred by sightings of the first pack of wolves to be spotted in the state in almost a century. Named the Shasta Pack, because of their discovery in southeastern Siskiyou County near Mount Shasta, the family of gray wolves is made up of two adult parents and their five pups. Through DNA analysis of scat samples, scientists determined that both adult wolves were members of the Inmaha track in northeast Oregon and related to OR7, who after his visits to the state settled in southern Oregon and started the Rogue Pack. The excitement over a new pack of wolves having taken up residence in the state was quickly overshadowed by their abrupt disappearing act. Alarmingly, the Shasta Pack went missing and has not been seen since May of 2016, when an image of a single juvenile was captured by a remote trail camera. California Department of Fish and Wildlife don't believe any foul play is involved in their having gone off the radar, but their abandonment of their breeding grounds is unusual for an established pack. Officials continue to search for the missing pack. Unfortunately, none of the Shasta Pack is collared, which makes the search all that more difficult. However, a spark of good news was announced just this week when one of the young wolves was spotted in an unlikely place, northwestern Nevada. DNA tests of scat left in the area near Fox Mountain, about 20 miles east of the border with California, recently confirmed that a young male from the Shasta Pack was in Nevada last November. The whereabouts of the other Shasta Pack members remain unclear, but news of spotting in Nevada carries hope that the pack is thriving and that some members have even made their own journeys into new territories. The sighting in Nevada is similarly remarkable for a state which has also been without a confirmed wolf in nearly a century. Whether or not the male wolf came alone, which is most likely the case, the track shows the drive gray wolves have to disperse to suitable areas to call home, and the needs for states to be able to address and protect these sojourners on their arrival in the new land. Discovery of the Shasta Pack demonstrates the efforts to restore wolves in the Pacific West are gaining ground figuratively and literally. While the historical extent and numbers of gray wolves in California is not known for sure, there are accounts of wolves in several areas throughout the state. What is more certain is that the species was driven to extinction in this state when the last known wild wolf was killed in Lassen County in 1924. Other populations across the U.S. followed suit, suffering near destruction by the mid-1930s. In 1974, the species was officially listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. In an effort to boost the wolf's recovery in the wild, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reintroduced gray wolves into Yellowstone National Park, as well as central Idaho in 1995 and 1996. The Shasta Pack, like other packs originating in Oregon and parts of Washington, were descendants of a population reintroduced by the Fish and Wildlife Service into central Idaho. Their discovery in California signals these reintroduced populations are on the move and naturally dispersing throughout the historic range. The significance of the Shasta Pack in California is to protect endangered wolf populations as they naturally disperse throughout their native ranges cannot be understated. The call of the wild is a very real impulse for a pack of animals like the gray wolf. They need to move away from their birthing grounds and start a new life in a new land is not merely a voyage of discovery and a testing of one's mettle. It is a natural instinct that serves many purposes for a species' health and survival. Dispersal is an inherent response to competition over food and mating opportunities, environmental disruption, social aggression, and habitat availability. It is important for population regulation and diversity, social reorganization, and colonization. Wolves require large contiguous areas to move around in that include forest and mountain terrain. Suitable habitat must have sufficient access to prey, protection from excessive persecution, and areas for denning and taking shelter. As their populations in the Northwest and Rocky Mountain regions continue to recover, wolves will naturally disperse into territories they once inhabited or new territories that become suitable for their survival. And Trump has signed a bill to bait, trap, and kill Alaskan wolves and bears in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity. President Trump's sick war on wildlife is taking off. Last Monday, he quietly signed a bill that allows wolves and their pups to be killed in their dens and bears to be gunned down at bait stations in Alaska's National Wildlife Refuges. These refuges were designed to be a haven for animals, but they clearly won't play that role under Trump. The bill also allows aerial gunning and the use of steel-jawed leg-hold traps to hold the animals in place until they can be shot. Thanks to the 33,000 of you who took action urging Trump to veto this disgusting bill, the fight is not over, however. The Center for Biological Diversity has sued the Trump administration 3 times in the past week, and the resistance movement is growing stronger by the day. And the Air Force has agreed to help endangered Hawaiian seabirds. Following a notice of intent to sue, the U.S. Air Force has consented to help endangered seabirds, including by reducing light pollution from a Kauai facility in Hawaii that's been killing birds like Hawaiian petrels and Newell's shearwaters by disorienting them so that they will circle, become exhausted, and drop from the sky. There's still more to be done. Other light sources on Kauai are also killing seabirds, and power lines need to be addressed, said the center's Loyal Meyerhoff. But I'm very glad to see the Air Force making a solid promise to help prevent bird deaths. And a court has overturned denial of protection for a fierce little owl. In response to a lawsuit brought by the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies, a federal judge in Arizona has overturned a 2011 decision by the Fish and Wildlife Service that denied Endangered Species Act protection to the tiny but ferocious Cactus ferruginous pygmy owl. The court also overturned a policy making it far more difficult for species imperiled in important portions of their ranges to gain federal protection. The pygmy owl faces serious threats to its survival in the Sonoran Desert of Arizona and northern Mexico, but the service had denied protection anyway, arguing the bird was secure elsewhere. The latest landmark decision is a lifesaver for this tiny desert owl and many other species. And another Alaskan oil spill threatens beluga whales on the brink. We recently told you about an offshore pipeline leaking natural gas into Alaska's Cook Inlet, the home of one of Cook Inlet belugas, one of the world's rarest whale species. The gas spill has been ongoing since December 2016, discharging more than 24 million cubic feet of methane greenhouse gas pollution. Now Hillcorp has admitted there's another leak in Cook Inlet, this time from its offshore oil pipeline in federally protected habitat for the Cook Inlet belugas, of which just 340 individuals survive. The center has been defending these whales since 1999, and we're not stopping now. And a court has restored Utah prairie dog protections. A win not just for prairie dogs, but for endangered species across the country, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the federal government does have the authority to protect Utah prairie dogs and other endangered species that occur within a single state. In a stinging rebuke to extreme private property rights advocates, a Republican judge concluded that eliminating protections for purely intrastate species would leave a gaping hole and undercut the conservation purposes of the Endangered Species Act. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies submitted a friend of the court brief in the case supporting protections for prairie dogs. "We're tremendously relieved," said Noah Greenwald, of our endangered species director. "If the decision had gone the other way, iconic species like the Florida panther and southern sea otter would have lost protections." And the Himalayan glaciers have been granted the status of living entities for protection purposes in this story from AFP 9 News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. An Indian court has recognized Himalayan glaciers, lakes, and forests as legal persons in an effort to curb environmental destructions, weeks after it granted similar status to country's two most sacred rivers. In a decision that aims to widen environmental protections in the mountainous region, the court granted legal standing to glaciers Gangotri and Yamunotri that feed Indians' venerated Ganga and Yamuna rivers, which won the status in a landmark decision in March. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and you can listen to a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You can also listen to WNMB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts on Friday at 5:30 a.m. You can listen to KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., or WLSL 92.7 FM in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You can listen online to the Grateful Dread Public Radio, that's gdprnashville.org, once again gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m., and you can also find them on TuneIn and Spotify. You can listen to KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, or Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM. Both of these stations rebroadcast the Earth First Update, but don't list it in their schedules at a particular time. But you could also listen to RadioForAll.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net, where you can listen anytime online or download this or previous versions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update. It is free to download and air. My name is Uncle Dennis. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in to another edition of the Earth First Update.